Hey, how's it going, everybody? This is Chris. Welcome to episode 37 of NML Crossing, where it's just now dawning on me that had I not taken those sick days for COVID a few weeks ago, we'd have already finished this Asriel story by now. The good news is today we do wrap it up. The bad news is we still have to read the thing and discuss the thing. Not to give too deep a look behind the curtain here, but like my scripts are very formulaic. It's like I got the credits, I got the synopsis, then I have this little bit that I call talking time, and that's just where I gather my thoughts. And I usually bounce between the synopsis and the talking time as I script. It's like, okay, oh, I want to make sure I remember to bring this up, or I want to comment on this, or oh, there's an error here I want to not forget about. My talking time for this issue is blank. There's nothing there. So I'm kind of doing this without a net, which is not my style. But I'm just hoping that in the talking through the synopsis that I find something to say about the issue. Because as it stands now, it's going to be just a series of like groans and grunts. And I don't know if shaking my head makes a sound on the air, but if it does, that's what you'd be hearing. But with all that out of the way, how about we do this thing, eh? Let's get into it. This is Asriel, Agent of the Bat, number 49, February 1999 cover date. Story's called Gotham City Must Die. Written by Denny O'Neill with pencils by Roger Robinson. Inks James Pasco, colors Demetrius Basukos and Prismacolor, letters Ken Brusenak, edits Berrios and Carlin, cover price 2¼. And our cover here, I really don't dwell on covers. I probably should. You know, it would give me a few more things to talk about. But this cover promises that this will be the last time we see Asriel in his classic duds. Because he's about to get fitted for a head sock. You remember when that was like a big deal? I mean, not the head sock, because we talked about that last episode, but just the idea that a character is changing their costume. Like, I remember during the, it might have been the Joe Quesada run on Iron Man, like after Busick and Chen left. Quesada came on before he was editor-in-chief, of course, and like one of the stories he was doing was was centered around a redesign of Iron Man's armor. And like every month, like the corner box, it was a corner circle back then. It would have like an under construction thing with like a little bit more of the armor, the new armor showing. I don't think we do that anymore, mostly because I don't think any two writers can agree on what costumes look like anymore. They change from page to page, panel to panel, book to book, definitely. So, there is something a bit adorable about this cover being just really hyping up the fact that in the landmark 50th issue of Asriel, he's going to have a new set of duds. So, I don't know. Thought I'd mention it. Let's get into the book. Now, we open with Nicholas Scratch holding court, and he's about to explain to some of the world's leading financiers why Gotham City must die. And he's also about to go on national television to pitch the same thing to the, you know, the American people. One of the financiers scoffs, and we're not even a page into this. He refers to Nick as a rock and roller, which I swear, in the past few days, saying that on this show is the most I've ever said rock and roller in my entire life. We also get a reminder that Nick has a PhD, an IQ off the charts, and a portfolio that would dwarf Warren Buffett's. I could get crude and talk about other things that we could brag about with Nick Scratch, but we won't. Now we learn here that he gave these money men $10,000 each to show up here, which, I mean, we're talking about Buffett money? That honestly doesn't sound like a whole lot of scratch. No pun intended, considering the portfolio. Anyway, he's trying to convince them that the closure of Gotham City will benefit them financially. and one of them pipes up to ask if this proposal is in any way unethical. And we get some sort of, like, ethics are in the eye of the beholder sort of BS, you know. From here, we jump to JPV, who's chatting up Babs in his car. She's still calling him Bright Eyes, and is still kind of flirty with this absolute zero of a character. Anyway, JPV is calling to ask for a favor. You see, he overheard Nick Scratch talking about doing something to Supreme Court Chief Justice Osgood Rockforth. And Osgood is, he's meeting with other justices this very day to discuss the legal ramifications of shutting Gotham City down. Now, Babs doesn't want to defy Batman by giving JP any information about this meeting, but she does anyway. It's like I really shouldn't do this, but since you're Asriel, I guess I will. She shoots him over a map to Rockbirth's estate, which, I mean, if Rockbirth's doing it, you might assume it was at his house? I don't know. Back to Scratch. He says that shutting down Gotham City will be an enormously moral event, which is really all the convincing that these financiers seem to require in order to co-sign this this little deal. He then prepares himself to deliver this message on television, and we zip over to Rockforth's place, where we see that the justices are all getting ready to tune in to Nick Scratch's address. We learn that this meeting is the informal chat before the formal meeting at the Capitol to discuss Bruce Wayne's testimony and plea. And we also learn that this estate is currently being guarded by a slew of Marines. Anyway, Nick Scratch's address kicks off. He claims to feel nothing but compassion for the good people of Gotham City, but also points out what they've had to endure of late. Plagues, riots, earthquakes, and, well, a collection of the worst bad guys on the entire planet. He asks why this is, and concludes that all this bad stuff is going down because the city itself is evil. Cursed, even. Nothing more than a Gomorrah. He begs the people of Gotham to up stakes and get the F out of the city. Do so for themselves, and do so for their children. If they stay, he says, the only thing they'll get is damnation. It's worth noting here, we're seeing, like, reactions as this is playing out. And among those is Babs. She's watching this performance, and she claims that Scratch almost has her convinced. Scratch continues, and turns his attention to running down the heroes of Gotham for hiding behind masks, and dressing up like bats, which, as we all know, represent devilry? Okay. Meanwhile, JPV rolls up on the Rockforth estate, and he's immediately turned away. Because of course he is. Would you ever think you'd just be allowed to walk in on, like, a Supreme Court justice's house? So dumb. He like, tries to say he's a student, and he's here for, like... it's so bad. Anyway, the Marines tell him to beat it, and so he drives a little ways away. Next thing we know, he's all dressed up in his Asriel duds, and I guess he drops a brick on the gas pedal of his Volkswagen, because the next thing we know, Asriel's surfing atop his car as it barrels towards the Marines at the gate. They open fire, obviously. The VW crashes into a Humvee, and Asriel leaps over the fence and onto the lawn. Like, did Michael Scott write this? I mean, this just sounds like such, like, action for the sake of it, but it makes no sense. It serves nothing, because once inside, Asriel still has to fight his way through Marines. Like, a bunch of Marines are there. So, I mean, if he was planning to have to fight anyway, why do the thing with the car? Why wreck his car? Why risk killing Marines? I mean, why not just bite his way in from the get-go, or hop the fence, you know? I mean, the guards aren't all around the perimeter of this place, they're just at the entry. Anyway, he fights his way through, and he crashes through a window and shouts a warning to the justices. He tells them to get the F out of there right away. Asriel is then shot in the back by one of the still-conscious Marines, a shot which he shakes off. He then spots a caterer's table. Because, I mean, there's a meeting going on here. There's a bunch of people gathered to chat and watch this address and talk about the Bruce Wayne plea. So he plays up a hunch. He picks the entire catering table up and throws it out another window before tackling Osgood What's-His-Face to the ground. Bada bing, bada boom, the catering table then explodes. As the dust literally settles, he introduces himself as, quote, the Savior, and tells Ozzie that Gotham City must not die. We jump back to Nick Scratch. He calls rehabilitating Gotham City an immoral and pointless act. Just, you know, bad money after bad money, a waste of billions of dollars. Dollars that could be used better elsewhere. You know, there are starving children. It's really that trite, you know, what the argument that he's giving here. It's like, Anyway, in closing, he literally says Gotham City must die on television. He strides off the stage like a peacock, and he's congratulated by one of the financiers for a job well done. Now, this takes us to a Channel 10 news report, where Dick Johnson gives us the result of the Supreme Court vote. It turns out they voted against Bruce Wayne's proposal, but Osgood Rockforth wound up being on Gotham City's side. He was like the sole, nay vote, or a vote, I don't know. We zoom out, and we see that JPV is watching this news report, and that he's just been joined by Batman. Batman tells him he did a good job changing Ozzy's mind, even though it didn't wind up doing much of anything in the grand scheme of things. Batman asks how Azrael knew there was a bomb in the catering table. John Paul says he didn't. It was just a suspicion, since the table was the only out-of-place piece of furniture in the room. And shouldn't it be? Like, bomb or no bomb, a catering table's gonna look different than an office full of... Oh, Jesus. Like, is anybody listening... Do you, like, coordinate your foldable catering tables with your actual furniture? Like your, you know, ornate wooden pieces or glass pieces? Do you, like, try to coordinate your disposable catering tables with that? Yeah, me too. Now, Batman, it's not all sunshine here. He then tells Azrael that he effed up getting into the estate. He calls him out on his reckless use of a Volkswagen, and how acting so brashly made it so Batman would have to go out of his way to cover JP's tracks. Well, our avenging angel apologizes for disobeying Batman, to which the big man says it showed intelligence and courage. And heck, he almost saved Gotham City. No, he didn't. They shake hands with a weirdly smirking Batman, suggesting that their working arrangement might not be as over and done with as previously thought. So that's all it took. And Batman's smiling here. You just lost your city, dude. Okay. That's where we end it, mercifully. Next time out, we do the other half of that flip book from the other day. And we're going to be heading over to Shadow of the Bat for 3 in a row. And I can tell you, it's going to be good. It's going to be good. Not only compared to this, but just in general, it's going to be very, very good. I'm looking forward to talking about it. I'm looking forward to the next 9 episodes, as a matter of fact. We got the 3 issues of Shadow, and then we got 6 issues all by Chuck Dixon. 3 Batman, 3 Detective, and then we are in No Man's Land proper. But what can we say about this? I don't know. I'm really struggling here to think of anything to say that I haven't already said. And when I put these shows together, I always do them with like an eye toward putting out compilations. You know, like I've done that with X-Labs, I've done that with the Cosmic Treadmill, where I'll lump shows and I'll release them as like one, you know, big bite, you know? So conventional wisdom would say that I would put together these last 3 episodes as like, this is the Azrael bit of the Road to No Man's Land. So I don't want to be too repetitive, you know, but have I used the word dorky enough over the past few days? Because this was dorky. It almost feels like it was like written by AI, you know? It really felt like there was no substance to this. We just like jumped from scene to scene here. I mean, the ending of this issue compared to the ending of the last issue, and the ending of the last issue was like the only thing that I had anything nice to say about, you know, because it was like Batman reaming, you know, Azrael for being garbage, for not being all that great at anything he does. And here, even after like screwing up the mission and not really doing much of anything worthwhile, and defying the order, and going out while he's wanted for murder of a senator in the same costume that 18,000 people saw him in, and was on the news, because there were amateur videos being shot in the crowd during that ridiculous concert, he still goes out dressed as himself, a wanted criminal. Breaks into a Supreme Court justice's house and starts throwing furniture around after beating up Marines and driving his car into a whole group of Marines. And Batman's like, yeah, good job. And perhaps the worst sin of this entire three-part epic we just read is that it never really crossed into the so bad it's good category, because at least then we could enjoy it for being silly and stupid and just nuts. Like, I gave Denny credit for writing this in earnest last episode. And when we did last episode, I saw that as a good thing. I saw that as a plus. Here, it's like a point against, because it's not written to be silly. It is actually written to be, like, a big part of this Road to No Man's Land story. And it's just not good. I hate to say it. I hate to be negative about any books that we cover and on any show or, you know, article I write. But I can't think of anything really good to say about it. Like, this entire Azrael story could have been told in one issue. We didn't need two additional issues for it. Like, we wasted a few pages on Azrael talking to Oracle, trying to get an address that he could have found anywhere else. I don't think I have much more to say about it. I don't want to belabor it, and I don't want to oversell it. I guess I'll just say I'm kind of disappointed. This is the first, you know, complete story that we're walking away from in this entire project, where it's just like, my review can be summed up in one word, and that word is oof. Not great, not great. But, of course, it's just one idiot's opinion. If you read this and got something more out of it, God bless you. And please tell me. Tell me what it is you got out of it, because maybe I'm just missing something. But yeah, I think that's where we'll stop. We don't have any letters pages here because, of course, you know, we haven't been doing Azrael every single time. So the letters are talking about an issue we never covered. So won't be much, you know, to talk about here. So we won't. Instead, we'll hop into our own letters page here. We're going to hop into the NML bag, and we got a few messages to discuss here. And we're going to start with our friend CJ, who's writing in about some of the back matter from last episode. And he says, a few thoughts on the NML bag. I'm right there with Chris Bailey on two things. And Chris Bailey did write in a wonderful letter that we covered last episode. He says, one, the comics as addiction path. I, too, started only buying the things I was interested in before getting sucked or suckered into buying crossovers, then settling into buying things I'm interested in. Now, I largely only use digital subscriptions and buy trades, but I normally buy used trades since I don't have much expendable income. Paying almost a house down payment for art for my comics over the past 8 years and now trying to buy our first house doesn't leave a lot of extra income. True that. Buying houses these days is pretty crazy. It's hit some heights that I feel your pain. I do feel your pain on that. Now, for your trajectory in what you buy, I think that's a very healthy way of doing it. It's so easy to fall into the fear of missing out we talked about last episode, where you're just always worried that when you walk away from a book, that's when, A, it'll start getting good again, because I mean, so many of us have those can't quit you books. I've got more can't quit you books than actual books that I enjoy, which is to say, like, it's like a 95% to 5% split at this point. It's not great. Not great. I'm a very weak individual. But your ability to go from what you like to maybe expanding for crossovers and then whittling back down to what you like is enviable. I do envy that a lot. I used to buy used trades all the time. That was how I read a lot of comics back when, like, I'd be on a sabbatical from collecting for either budgetary or just burnt out reasons. And on my way back into the hobby, I would pick up some used trades, just try to catch myself back up. Thing of it is, a lot of the places that sell used trades around here, namely places like Half Price Books, have started to, I don't know if this is at all Half Price Books or just the few that are near me, like, they turned their trades into almost like a boutique shop where, like, you could find something that has out of print written on the price tag. Like, we're talking about Asriel. I found a Sword of Asriel trade at a Half Price Books probably 6 months ago or so, and I remember pulling it off the shelf, and it had a $50 price tag on it. $50, and it had OOP written on the price tag out of print. And it's like, that's, well, first of all, it's not half price. Second of all, $50 friggin', you kidding me? And it's a lot of their books had started going that way. Anytime I go to a Half Price Books and I pull a used trade off, it says it's out of print, and so it's worth 3 or 4 times over cover price. It's silly. It's very, very silly. I actually found the Sword of Asriel trade at a record store for $2 not too long ago. And I picked it up, and the first thing I thought was like, wow, they wanted 50 for this at the other store. I should just flip it, you know, but that ain't how I do things. But I do miss the days where I could, you know, head into any used bookstore and pick up a couple of trades for half price or less. You know, I do miss those days a lot. Back to CJ. He says, 2, slabs and variants as being something we're not interested in and something that's separate from the type of comic collecting we do. We buy to read comics, not have cool wall art and a future commodity. And that's true. I mean, I discussed this last episode. I don't even consider slabs to be comics, because they're not, you know. You transform them into, like CJ puts it here, wall art, you know. And it's the ugliest kind of wall art, too, because it's in that stupid ugly plastic thing with a 9.6 on it. It doesn't look good on a wall. To me, anyway. I mean, it's just one idiot's opinion, but I don't think they look good. I don't think there's really anything about them. If you like the cover, it's easy enough to blow it up and print it out and throw it on your wall. But I guess you wouldn't have that cool 9.6 on it. I don't know. And the idea of doing that as something that you'd resell, it's not black or white with me. I know that some people have issues that are very, very special to them. You know, it might be the first issue you ever read, or the first one you ever bought with your own money, or one that introduced you to a whole family of books that it's just a seminal book to you. I have no problem if you want to put that behind plastic. You want to save that. You want to have that as something you can look at every day as a reminder, and keeping it in this pristine condition. I can understand that, and I can appreciate that. I think, because with me, I over-romanticize everything. So a comic fan and their collection, that relationship to me is special. You know, and I've said it before, I'll say it again. These things all have dates on them, so we can kind of trace our entire lives through them. You know, I think that's something that's very special about any kind of periodical you might collect. And comics, for being serialized fiction stories that just span decades, nearly a century in some cases, I feel like our relationship with the books is special. So if you do have a book that's special to you and you want it preserved, I got no problem with it. It's this weird, manipulative, manufactured collectability that we're adding to something that in and of itself should be collectible on its own. Not only for value, but for what's inside these books. You know, the story, the characters, the heritage and lineage of these characters and their story, right? You're holding a piece of fictional history. And like I said, I do over-romanticize things, but I can't get down with that. And the variant covers, good grief. I talked about how long it took for me to ever try eBay. You know, eBay was just not my way of collecting comics. I always want to be in there on the ground, getting my fingers inky and dirty in disgusting bins, trying to find, you know, these books that I want to find, right? I was very, very stubborn about that for a very, very long time, where I could have had these, you know, these white whale books within a few days if I went the eBay route. And now that I've kind of broken my own, you know, ridiculously rigid rule about collecting, I don't really shop so much on eBay, but I do browse because, like I said, I'm looking for that Detective 880. I want to find that for a little bit less than what it's going for right now. So I hope that I can eventually find it. I found the first print of the Harley Quinn one-shot for peanuts, relatively speaking, a lot less than I ever expected to pay. So I do browse, and everything's variant covers now. You can't find a prime cover or cover A, if that helps. I can't find those anywhere. It's all this crappy variant stuff. Just, you know, Detective Comics 880. There's a variant of the Night Terrors Joker book that's a kind of a really ugly homage to it, and that's all that comes up. It's like, can we not do this? And then you have like the ridiculously ratioed variants, which it seems like they're only a really big deal the week they come out, because the following week we have a dozen more. A dozen's probably a very conservative number now. We have dozens more of these ratioed variants that are gonna steal the scene, you know, steal the spotlight. And then the week later, there'll be several dozen more. I can't get on board with it. I think I said it was like a dead cat bounce in the stock market. It's just the impression that there's movement without there actually being any life. It's kind of sad what the industry's become. You know, it's not about the books, not about the stories. It hasn't been for a long time. It's about, hey, do you have that 1 out of 1,000 Peach Momoko Rogue cover on an issue of Miracle Man? It's just silliness, but I'll stop for now on that. Let's go back to CJ. He says, there's one thing I disagree with Chris Bailey on. I wouldn't call the Krakoa X-Books unreadable. A mixed bag for sure. Continuity contradictions, but that's not only an X-Book issue. And it's bloated, true. But I thought it was the most exciting X-Books and Marvel has been in a while. It's one of the few lines I read individual issues for consistently, instead of waiting for the trade. There are a few other titles I do that for, but not families of titles. There's also a cool blog called House to Astonish that does annotations for each book, and they do a good job evaluating both the good and the bad, avoiding the too broad classification of the whole era as unreadable / unfun. They have a podcast too, but I haven't listened to it. Okay, yeah, I didn't go as far as saying they were unreadable. I did say they were not fun to read. And a lot of that has to do with what I intended to do with the books. You know, if I was just reading them and then chucking them in a box, I'm sure that I'd probably enjoy them and life a lot more than I do. The fact was that I was spending more time with these books than the people writing them. And I have very little doubt that that's true. Not a broad statement, not painting with the wide brush there, but I'm pretty sure I spent more time. I definitely spent more time than the editors, for sure. And, you know, familiarity breeds contempt and all that kind of stuff. And being, you know, the lone voice that would say some of the books weren't 10 out of 10, It's a lonely place to be. It's a pretty lonely place to be. I love that you bring up House to Astonish. House to Astonish, I've talked about my love for Usenet. You know, Usenet is where I just came up in digital comics fandom, right? House to Astonish is run by Paul O'Brien, who I've been a fan of his reviews and his work since the mid-1990s. He is what made me want to review comics back when I was a teenager. Paul O'Brien, to my mind, can do no wrong. I've read his annotations. I've read his reviews. I've saved his reviews. I've gone to the damn Wayback Machine and, like, copied and pasted his reviews on a private blog that I have just so I could check out his stuff again without having to have that stupid Wayback Machine banner on top of the page that gets in the way. I've listened to the podcast, too. It's been years since I've listened to the podcast, I think, because it's him and a guy, Al Kennedy, and they're both real good. I remember listening to them a lot when I was on the road back in probably 2011 to 2015 or so. I was on the road a lot, so I would listen to a lot of podcasts, and theirs was always one of my favorites. Definitely, I can't speak for the quality of it now, but back then it was always a good listen, for sure. And we're about to get into CJ's list for which books in the Hox Pox line that he liked and didn't like, and they are pretty much exactly, almost book for book, exactly how I would rank them as well. So we're not far off here at all. CJ says, I really liked Hox and Pox, Hellions, X-Men Red, Immortal X-Men, and Wolverine. I generally liked X-Factor, X-Men, X-Force, although that title definitely stretched decompression and not resolving storylines too much. New Mutants, but I thought the end of Ayala's run was very good, and Cable. I didn't like X-Corp. While the base idea could be interesting, it was not executed well. I didn't like Excalibur or Knights of X, which did get better at the end of its run, but Otherworld is not my favorite. The Second Marauders and Dark Web. And there were a few more minis that didn't generate much emotional reaction from me either way. I think that's a pretty good hit ratio for a line of books, especially such a big line of books. I think Fall of X is doing some similar stuff, strong promise, but inconsistent execution. And yeah, your list really lines up with mine almost beat for beat. Hox and Pox. Pox, when they got into the future stuff, I kind of checked out. But the overall Hox Pox experience was great. I was super psyched. I loved the fact that, I don't know if anybody's listened to those episodes, but I was reviewing that or analyzing that or talking about it in real time. You know, I would read it. I would check. I knew nothing about anything other than the fact that it was going to end with, you know, Krakoa being a thing. So I was throwing out these insane predictions all throughout the Hox and Pox bits of the show. And like people were writing in. There was a lot of excitement from listeners when I started that. Like people were writing in, it's like, oh, well, you're in for a ride. You're, you know, don't get scared off. This is this, you know, it's going to be interesting. And I was throwing out these wild sort of predictions and people were like, well, I don't want to ruin it for you. You know, it was a really good time. It was a lot of like synergy between listeners and me. And it was a lot of fun. And I really enjoyed it. I probably should have stopped after that, but that was good stuff. The first run of Marauders was great until the end. I really, really enjoyed that. That was a standout book that I expected very little from. But when Duggan was doing that, it was almost always going to be a good time. Sword, I wanted to hate. I wanted to hate Sword because I'm not a fan of how Al Ewing conducts himself online. You know, as a guy who creates content, the thought of blocking people willy-nilly that just seems silly to me. You know, he was blocking people who just wanted to write to him and say, hey, you're doing a great job. I can't wrap my head around that. So I wanted to hate that book, But I couldn't because it was good. And I mean, I've been accused of being negative simply for negativity's sake. And when I'm negative, there's like an agenda behind my negativity. That's a little peek behind the curtain there. But in any situation like that, it's like Sword and X-Men Red pop into my head as like, I didn't want to like that book, but I did. And I would recommend it to anybody, which, you know, it's, that ain't negativity for negativity's sake. That's begrudging positivity when I really didn't want to like it. Back to CJ's list here. Sabretooth and the Exiles, we enjoyed that. That was the Victor Laballe or Laballe. That was good. Legion Way of X was fantastic stuff. The Simon Spurrier Nightcrawler focus, loved it. Hellions was probably the best X book I've read in 20 years. Hellions could make you laugh. It could make you cry. It was a beautiful book. And I hated that it ended. There are very few books I can say that about, but Hellions kicked my ass. It was just so good. And that was another one I really didn't want to like because I thought it was a little silly, you know, just from the premise, but damn it, it was good. Damn it. X-Men Red, we talked about, I liked it. Immortal X-Men, I didn't read too much of it, but what I did read, I loved. And Wolverine was always a good time. Wolverine, the only complaint I had about it was that I didn't have much to say about it, other than the fact that I liked it, you know? That became almost a meme, to me anyway. When I cover an issue of Wolverine, it's like, yeah, I loved it, but I enjoyed it, but there ain't nothing to say. To the books that CJ liked generally, X-Factor. I thought X-Factor started terribly, but ended strong. And the fact that it ended the way it did kind of annoyed me because I feel like there was a lot more story that could have been told, but they were rushing to Inferno and the Trial of Magneto and stuff like that. X-Men was a middling book. The flagship never felt like the flagship. It felt like it never had an identity. It felt like, I don't know, it just never felt right. X-Force, that book did stretch decompression. Even now, I don't know if they've done anything with, like, the scribe or the chronicler? The guy who's writing the story and controlling Colossus? And, like, the sword, the Cerebro sword that was introduced 100 years ago? I mean, are they still working with that? It's been a long time, I don't know. New Mutants. New Mutants was okay. I was not as keen on the Ayala run because it felt very much like someone took 2 weeks of Psychology 101 and decided that every story needs to go through the prism of that. And as someone who's taken a decade of psych classes and has a few degrees, it's, I wasn't too keen on that. Cable, I thought was better. It was pretty good. I thought Cable was good. I kind of lumped that with Wolverine as being one of those books that was good, but there wasn't a whole lot to say about it. Now, as for the books that CJ didn't like, X-Core. Oh, man. That, you know, that was the worst X-Men book I ever read until I read X-Men Green, because that was terrible. X-Corp was horrible. An interesting idea, and it was actually one of the things that made me, like, wish we had a book like X-Men Unlimited back then, like a real X-Men Unlimited, like, where, you know, X-Corp could get 6 pages every quarter. It's like, that's all you really need. We didn't need however many issues that ran, 4 or 6 or 5 maybe. Yeah, 5 because of the new trade sizes, I guess. Excalibur and Knights of X, didn't care for that. Didn't care for that. That was usually a rough read. The second Marauders was absolutely dreadful. And that was, yeah, did not care for that. Dark Web, I never got to. I still have them in my overflowing short box of X-Men books, but I have not read any of that yet. I read the Free Comic Book Day lead into it, but not anything after that. And of course, there were as CJ points out here, some minis that didn't do a whole heck of a lot. I think recently there have been a bunch of minis, right? Like there's the Nike, the, what's it, the Uncanny Spider-Man, there's, or the, yeah, I think it was Uncanny Spider-Man, there's the Children of the Vault, like Bishop had a mini, Betsy Braddock had a mini, Cable's got another one now. It's a lot of books, a lot of books. Hey, you know, my thinking that it's unfun has a lot to do with what I was doing with the books, not so much the experience of reading them. I've read worse, of course. So, you know, like I said last episode, unreadable might be a bit too strong for me, but definitely not so much fun. Back to ZJ. He says, a follow-up to my Green Lantern Green Arrow point from yesterday's post. The first time I read it was in high school, and I didn't really like it, aside from the Neil Adams art. I had heard Reddit talked up a bunch for its historical impact, but I hadn't had much Silver Age, Early Bronze Age experience, and I went into reading it with a mainly, at the time, modern-day perspective, and some perhaps outsized expectations. Then I read it about a couple years ago, 15 years after I read it the first time, with more of a historical perspective and with more historical comics experience and appreciation, and I quite enjoyed my second reading of it. I wouldn't have said it was great, but I would have said it was better than an average superhero comic. And I think that's true. I think that's fair. Because kind of offbeat as they were compared to what you might be getting in the pages of Superman the same month, there was definitely something special about them. And while they didn't necessarily all, they weren't all, you know, home runs, it was different, and it felt, I mean, I wasn't there at the time, of course, but in becoming more of a student of the Bronze Age myself, I can definitely see that there's more substance there. Light compared to what we might get nowadays, and maybe from the 80s on, but there was definitely substance when you would compare it to a random... I can't throw the Ray out there for this time, because I don't think the Ray had a book back then, but... it was the Ray... The old Ray was part of the Freedom Fighters, right? So it would be a little bit deeper than you might get on an issue of Freedom Fighters. Or Superman, of course. It's different. It's different, and as such, it's kind of an outlier for the Bronze Age books, because one of the reasons I had such a hard time getting into the Bronze Age was the fact that so many of the stories felt disposable and interchangeable and pointless. You know, continuity was different. There were multiple Earths. I couldn't keep track of stuff. And I, you know, the thing I would always say is, like, I could read an issue of the X-Men where they fight Magneto, or I can buy an issue of Superman where he fights a giant lizard, you know, that we'll never hear from again or see again or care about. So I would always just go for what was comfortable and what felt like it mattered. So I can definitely see how Green Lantern, Green Arrow, being so different, having such social substance to it, would make it stand out as being special. Even, you know, all the silliness involved in it. And I realize I'm just really talking myself in circles now, so I'll just move on to CJ's next point. He says, I appreciate your explanation of why you decided not to bundle some issues or story arcs into one episode. I understand it, both for your personal motivation and for how it could lead to more discussion with your listeners. Plus, it helps avoid the thorny issue of you deciding to only do one episode for a multiple-issue story arc that someone else loved. I think it's more just the approach I would have used. But I've only appeared on podcasts instead of running my own, so my viewpoint is more how it would fit into my motivation and free time bandwidth. And, you know, what I said last episode about it being a motivator, that is true, 100%, but it's also not the entire story. I'm just not good at synopsizing stories, like full stories. I remember trying to do that with the Cosmic Treadmill. I've tried doing that personally, I'm not good at summarizing. I'm not good at brevity, as is, you know, should be apparent by the fact that I've been talking without taking a breath for the past you know, what is it, 7 hours now? I don't know how long the episode is right now, but brevity is not my strong suit. So to distill an entire story arc down to the high points, low points, I don't have that capability. So doing it the hard way is the easy way for me. Like I said, on my tombstone, it will read, he made this a lot harder than it needed to be. And that could be on the tombstone for Chris's On Infinite Earths or the Cosmic Treadmill channel. I make things a lot harder than it needs to. But I did consider doing clumps when I was considering getting back into X-Lapsed last summer into the fall. I came very close. I came very, very close to doing that, and it was just unwieldy, you know? Like, if I were a juggler, I could only juggle, like, two objects. You throw a third, fourth, or fifth in there, and they're scattered all over the floor. I need my focus to be kind of, like, laser sharp, I guess, if that's even... Who knows? But that's the end of CJ's email. I would like to thank him for such a thoughtful response. And hopefully my reply didn't come off as too long-winded or too me. Because I can get very, very me. But thank you. Thank you so much. Next up, we got Chris Yu talking about, well, the first part of the Azrael story. And he says, "This was bad. I have a love for old comics when 40 and 50-year-old writers were trying to write teenage characters, and the more they tried to sound cool, the less cool and realistic they sounded. But while the Silver Age stories are quaint, seeing this trope in a more modern comic is cringeworthy. Another good reason not to read Azrael." And yeah, because this isn't like a zany Haney, right? This is not someone who you would think... Like we just talked about with CJ's message, this is a guy who was kind of at the forefront of social relevancy in comics, at least on the DC side. And he wasn't just some, you know, weird Bob Haney guy, right? And to see it here, it doesn't have the old Haney charm, unfortunately. And that makes it... You know, it doesn't cross into the so bad it's good. It doesn't cross into, not to say that Bob Haney was bad, but some of the stuff got silly. And it was like, it embraced the silliness. Where this is like what your grandfather thinks, you know, the goth kids would talk about and say. And it misses the mark. Back to Chris. He says, "Every time you mention Nicholas Scratch, I kept picturing the Marvel character of the same name. I guess Agatha Harkness's son had a bigger impact on me than the DC character." And I knew there was another Nicholas Scratch. I couldn't pinpoint. Because, I mean, it's such an easy name, right? Nicholas Scratch. You figure any kind of demonic sort of character would have a name like that. But I couldn't place where the Marvel Nick Scratch was. Maybe I will fan fiction an amalgamated version. We'll bring back the Amalgam Universe in fan fiction form, and we'll do... We would just call him Nicholas Scratch, because we're putting the... I don't... Anyway, back to Chris. He says, "The best thing John Byrne did during his reboot of Superman was to keep the Kents alive. They were a great part of the Bronze Age Superboy comics and made Byrne Superman more man than super. Having the source of Clark's morality to be there for Clark to seek reassurance from when he was having a crisis humanized the character of Superman." And yeah, we discussed that last episode, where it definitely humanized the character and made him more relatable. Because I think, you know, so many of us can relate to seeking guidance from our parents, maybe getting some guidance we didn't ask for in the first place. And... you know, to have Superman there, and we know that he's the Boy Scout, right? And having the ability to see where he got those values from, in not flashback form, but like just growing old with him growing up, it was very special. It was just very special. Back to Chris. He says, the problem with Jack Drake is that he didn't know that Tim was Robin. There was no support from him for Tim in his hero persona. If Tim was troubled by something happening to him as Robin, he couldn't seek advice from his father. It was really a conflict for Tim to have to keep his dad in the dark about being Robin, while having this other father figure in Bruce that he could be completely honest with. Jack didn't add anything to Tim's character. He was just someone to sneak past so Tim could go out as Robin. That's an excellent point. That's an excellent point that I didn't really consider. Before we discuss it more, I want to get to Chris's next point. He says, thinking about it now, I seem to remember Jack Drake as always being sickly after surviving the experience that killed Tim's mom. Tim was worrying about his father a lot. It seems like maybe they were going for an Aunt May vibe with him. Why not copy the blueprint for Spider-Man with a teen hero that DC wanted to be a solo hero and not just the back half of Batman and... Another excellent point. And something I didn't put together. I didn't put that together either. My Jack Drake experience is minimal. It's minimal, but I do remember him being sickly, I think he was in a wheelchair for a bit, like early on. And Tim was worried about him. And I didn't put the Aunt May thing together, but I think you might have nailed it there. I definitely think you did. But to the point of him not knowing that Tim was Robin, that's another thing I didn't think about. And it makes me wonder if there are any conversations between Tim and Jack that, like, don't, of course, reveal that he's Robin, but... like, kind of brush up against it in, like, a... like, maybe making the problem he's having as Robin a little bit more universal. Or a little bit more general. To where any kid could be having this sort of conflict or challenge. And seeking advice from his father. And then also having Bruce there, too. And just see how the answers vary. See how the experiences vary. I don't know if that ever happened or not. Like I said, my experience with this era is minimal, relatively speaking. So that's interesting. If anybody out there knows if there were any of these chats, let me know. Because, I have the full run of Robin, because of course I do. I haven't read much of it, but I have it. But if there's anything out there that I need to be checking out, please hit me up and let me know. But I want to thank you so much for raising those points, Chris. Like I said, I didn't think about those, so that's the best part about the NM mailbag, right, is sharing ideas and hopefully you all educating me a little bit, so I am, talking a little bit less out of my ass. So thank you so much for that, Chris. We got one more message here. It's a quickie here, but I wanted to include it. It's from our friend Andrew. And he says, Chris, I've been catching up on the last couple of weeks' episodes because I've been super busy at work. Now, here's the question. Can I ask you what song you use as the theme? I hum it all day. And I wanted to include that because this isn't the first time I was asked about the song. The song, it's a special song. It's a good song. It's a haunting song, if you've heard the whole thing. And I'll name it here so you can check it out if you'd like to. But it's a song called All Comes Crashing by a band called Metric. I believe they're a Canadian band. But it's a song that's, it's about not knowing what might come. Like, some of the lyrics are like, for all I know, this could be my last night. So you don't know what's coming. And then, of course, there's the chorus of Crashing Down, which plays into what we're talking about here on the show. But it's actually a song that I was considering using for that relaunch of X-Lapsed. There were a couple of songs I was planning to use for that. One was Here Comes Your Man by the Pixies. I thought that would be funny, because I'd been gone for so long. And I'd probably just use it for the first couple of episodes, of course. But this song, the first few words of it, I used the beginning of the song at the end of the episode. And it's Starting Over Won't Be Easy. And that really spoke to me. Because I'm in the car a lot. I'm listening to music. This song was on a lot last summer. And it spoke to me. It's like, as I always thought about bringing the show back, and it just puts it plainly. Starting over won't be easy. You don't know what you have anymore when you walk away from something or you let something kind of no pun intended, you let something lapse. And so it's a powerful song. It's a really, really good song. It's the tune, the lyrics, it's very, very haunting. It's very, very special. So hopefully I'll remember to link to something in the show notes. But if not, it's All Comes Crashing by Metric. And I want to thank Andrew for listening, of course, writing in, and reminding me to name that song, name that tune. How did I miss that? Name that tune, name that song. What's wrong with me? Anyway, I think that's where we're going to cut out for today. Stretch this episode out a lot longer than I ever expected to. And if you're still listening, thank you. Thank you very much. And of course, if anybody out there would like to join the conversation, I invite you to do so. Chris is on infiniteearths.com, weirdcomicshistory@gmail.com, Facebook, Twitter, all those places. But I think this is where I will let you get back to your day. But first, I'd like to thank you all for spending some of it with me. And until next time, as always, I'll talk to you again real soon. See ya. Starting over when the story's got an astounding twist. You've